It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk about a new study that says positive or negative body image can affect both mental and physical health.
First, people around the country are reacting after the largest mass shooting in U.S. history at a gay nightclub called Pulse in Orlando, Florida.
The co-founder of the nightclub said in a Washington Post interview that the nightclub was named in honor of her brother who died of AIDS at the height of the epidemic. The club was a focal point of the LGBT community in Orlando.
President Obama made a statement after the shooting yesterday and highlighted the significance of where the shooting took place.
The shooter targeted a nightclub where people came together to be with friends, to dance and to sing and to live. The place where they were attacked is more than a nightclub. It is a place of solidarity and empowerment where people have come together to raise awareness, to speak their minds, and to advocate for their civil rights.
Today, we want to hear from you on safe spaces for the LGBT community. What spaces in Wisconsin do you consider supportive and safe for the queer community? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Maybe you're somewhere that you think needs a better safe space. Again, call 800-642-1234.
Washington Post Civilities columnist Stephen Petro joins us now. He wrote a piece about what the shooting means for safe spaces for the LGBT community, and it's posted on the Central Time Facebook page. Stephen, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be with you.
You've written that violence or the threat of violence has been embedded in the LGBT community's consciousness for a long time. Can you describe what you mean by that?
You know, I'll talk a little bit about it personally, and then I'll broaden it from there. But when this happened in Orlando yesterday, it really took me back to 1978. I just graduated from college. I was living in Durham, North Carolina, and the news came that Harvey Milk had been assassinated. For those who don't remember, Harvey Milk was the gay civil rights leader, really the gay civil rights leader, and he was taken out by a colleague who had been on the Board of Supervisors because of his openness about his sexual orientation. And I think for a generation such as mine, that has always stayed in the back of our minds. There was a time about 10 years later, I was in San Francisco with a new boyfriend, and I was attacked. He was attacked because we were holding hands. So our experience is actually not that uncommon to many then, and unfortunately to many today. I interviewed a 24-year-old genderqueer activist in New York for my column, and he said, you know, he just expects that there could be violence on any street corner, really in just about any public place. But what shocked him about what happened at the Pulse Dance Club was the fact that this was really a sacred space to the LGBT community, that it was a private space, and so this violation almost goes deeper than many of the others that we have grown accustomed to, and brought it home in a much more personal way when folks who are simply going out to dance and to sing and to have a good time, you know, wind up not seeing the sunrise because someone has come in and shot them with an assault rifle.
Is that new, that aspect of it, that this wasn't something that happened on the sidewalk in a more public place? This was a place that felt like it was an extension of the community in a way.
You know, it's new to these times. We have not seen something like that in recent years. Go back to the 1970s, and really one of the worst attacks on gay people was at a bar in New Orleans in 1973 when someone incinerated that bar and 32 gay men died. And after that, there were a number of similar attacks in other bars. But then this type of attack really did not happen for decades. And I'm starting to think that it is tied to the rate of progress that we're seeing. And almost one of those, you know, two steps forward, one step backward, because the 70s and the early 80s were times also of great progress and struggle. Think back to Anita Bryant. And now we've seen so much progress that this backlash, whether it's what happened in Orlando or the restroom bills in places like Mississippi and North Carolina, or the so-called Religious Freedom Acts. You know, all of that is part of the backlash, I think, to the forward steps that we have been realizing.
Right. The Supreme Court recently legalized same-sex marriage, and as you said, it seemed as though it hadn't happened for a couple of decades. So does that sort of thing, do you think, make people, surprise people at this juncture, thinking maybe we had turned a corner?
You know, Veronica, it's really such a good question, because after the Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage in all 50 states last June, I was very vigilant, as were some other members of the LGBT community, in saying it's not over, and we do not have federal protections for jobs or for public accommodations. There's still so much that is yet to be done, and the focus and the attention that was on marriage equality was great, and that was a really big win. I got married as a result, but there's really great deal left to be done in terms of both acceptance, which there we're talking about sort of social mores and manners, as well as basic equality. You know, the line that I hear so often is, you can get married on Sunday, but you can be fired from your job simply because you're gay on Monday. That's the dichotomy that we're living in, and I guess now we'll add into that, and on Saturday night you could be gunned down in a bar.
And the president just talked about this in a speech with remarks that were prescient given what happened. He talked about the threat of violence that still exists for LGBT people around the world. Do you think that this will change anything in the way that we think about what it is and isn't safe, and what work still needs to be done?
Well, the president's remarks were at the LGBT reception that he has held annually at the White House. That was last Thursday. And they really were clairvoyant in a very sad way, and he is right to speak of the really unspeakable violence that happens around the world, and now we have matched that here at home. If I see any silver thread in this, and it is that the LGBT community has come together before in times of great adversity, thinking here of the AIDS crisis, and from my reporting and from what I'm seeing on social media, that is happening right now. And I'll just also give you a specific example, Veronica. I interviewed Jim Obergefell, who is the named plaintiff, the lead plaintiff in last year's Supreme Court case. And he's been a very prominent activist since then. And after these deaths were reported yesterday morning, I talked with him on the phone, and it really wound up being an emotional conversation. At the end, I asked him if he was afraid personally, and he said that he was. But then he also said that he tries not to think about it that way, and quote, I can't let that paralyze me or stop me from my advocacy work. I can't let that stop me from fighting for others. And I think in many ways his sentiments are being echoed by many other members of this community and many of our allies. You know, we're definitely part of a larger community here. And if anything, I hope this is a wake-up call to the kinds of homophobia that still exists, the kinds of transphobia. I understand we don't understand much about the shooter's motivation, but we do know that there really is rampant homophobia and transphobia in this country, and those are the entities that need to be fought against.
Stephen, what do you hope happens next? You were getting at it a little bit there. This story has so much involved in it. There's gun control issues. There's domestic terror issues. There's the LGBT community. And it's hard to say which one will end up having the most resonance as we go forward. But what do you hope that people talk about and think about?
Well, one of the things that I do hope that we talk about are those people who lost their lives at the Pulse Club. You know, we're just beginning to get all of the names. But it's very important to remember them, to know them, so that they did not die in vain. And in previous times, we focused so much attention and media attention on the perpetrators, and they are the ones who become center stage. And that is happening here, too. You know, there's a lot of news story and news coverage about the shooter, his father, all of these different elements. But we need to remember those who perished. They're important to our collective consciousness and to our community. Coming out of this, we also, I think we see a very sad and powerful lesson that acceptance is still far off. And GLAAD did a study, a repeat study this spring, and showed that 30% of Americans still have issues about equal acceptance for LGBT people. It's better, but there's really much more to be done. So if there was complacency that was setting in the post-Supreme Court ruling era past year, I think that it's time to understand that that's really, we need to go deeper than that, and there is more work to be done to bring us to full equality.
Now, you took the long view in your piece. You looked back at the assassination of Harvey Milk. With that in mind, the scope of history, the sweep of the advance of LGBT rights and civil liberties, what do you want to say to the LGBT community going forward?
What do I want to say, did you say?
Right. What would your message be today?
Well, my message would be pretty much what it would have been back in 1978, when Harvey Milk was assassinated, which is that do not fight hate with hate. Fight hate with love, because love wins in the end. And I know so many friends are so angry, as am I, by what has happened in Orlando and by what has happened in North Carolina and elsewhere. But anger only gets you so far. And I think that by taking the high road, continuing to push, to advocate, and to show how we're not equal, how we're not accepted, that is the way forward. But I certainly understand, the impulse now, almost the need now, to express that anger, and I am seeing it overflow on Facebook, because what did happen in Orlando points out that any of us really could have been there, whether it's that bar or another bar, or an LGBT center on college campus or high school. We're all vulnerable in ways that we really put out of our minds. And it's important to understand that we don't live in that country yet.
Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Stephen Petro. He's the civilities columnist for The Washington Post. His recent piece about safe spaces for the LGBT community is posted on the Central Time Facebook page.
Next, we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How are you affected by the shootings in Orlando? If you're a member of the LGBT community or an ally, tell us what you consider a safe space in Wisconsin. Are there places or communities you recommend being a part of? And do you think a tragedy like Orlando is a response to the rapid advance of gay rights? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up a little later in the hour, we'll talk more about the mass shooting in Orlando with Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan.
Right now, we want to hear from you and how you're responding to the shooting in Orlando, how that impacted, how you feel about maybe safe spaces for the LGBT community. Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're a member of that community or an ally here in Wisconsin, tell us what you consider a safe space and where you'd like the national discussion to go next as we process this as a country. You can call us at 800-642-1234. And Stephen Starkey is with us right now, Executive Director of Outreach, South Central Wisconsin's LGBT Community Center. And Stephen, thank you for being with us right now. What was your first response when you heard about this shooting in Orlando?
Well, when I saw the news on TV, I wept. It was just so sad to see, the number of people that had died, the number of people that were injured, and how the community was trying to get the medical attention to people to do the blood drive. The tragedy was just unbelievable. So that was my first response.
And as we heard from Stephen Petro from The Washington Post just a moment ago, he was saying that this makes things feel less safe, that it already there's a history there of possibly there being violence on a street, in a place of worship, and now in a place that's a community hub, really. How does that affect the sense of safety?
There has been a long history of gay bashing, of gay murders, of harassment for the LGBT community, and I think that this just underscores that we are still not safe in the United States. There are still a lot of homophobic groups and hate groups. And people who would wish to do us harm, and so it's very sad that 30 or 40 years after the gay movement started, the LGBT movement started, we still have a long way to go.
And what do you hope the conversation, how do you hope that evolves? I mean, so we're only a day past this terrible tragedy, but what would you like to see be the focal point going forward?
Well, I think that we need to think about safety. When we realized that there was an attack on a gay nightclub that was specifically targeting LGBT people, and also it was discovered that there was a truckload full of weapons that was at the Gay Pride march in L.A., that it seems that, forces are mobilizing against us, maybe in a way that hasn't happened for a long time, and that we need to be more vigilant and more safety conscious kind of do some planning in the future. I think we need to continue to do the things that the LGBT movement has been doing for over the years in terms of working on our political and legal rights, but also continuing to work to change society's view of LGBT people.
And in terms of the LGBT community and how it responds together, are you seeing this as a unifying sort of event, and a horrible event, but one that will bring people together and have people, maybe new coalitions of people working together?
Yes, we are seeing that happening in Madison already. I understand there's actually three vigils being held tonight. There's one that we're promoting that's at the Capitol building at 7 p.m., a candlelight vigil. I think there's also a religious service that's being held in town, and so people are coming together, I think, to share their grief and kind of try to understand this tragedy, but also figure out how to move forward.
And looking at support from the outside, we're here in Wisconsin, and this is, of course, a national event that people are responding nationally to. If people want to be allies outside of the Orlando community, what can people do to help?
Well, I know that there was a blood drive that was held in Orlando. And many gay men are not allowed to donate blood, so that's one thing that we can't do. But allies can certainly donate blood to make sure that there's enough blood, for the victims. That's one thing that people can do. Coming together, sharing kind of hope and strength, and continuing to do political activism is also important.
Let's take a caller now. We have Carol on the line from Clear Lake. Carol, thank you for joining us.
Sure. I just wanted to say that every time one of these shootings happens, I'm out of breath. it's just so horrendous. I really thought when 20 babies were murdered, something would happen. And I've been listening to an awful lot of the conversation over the last couple of days. And what's troubling to me is they seem to be, a lot of the conversation has to do with Islam. And this is really an act of homophobia. And I think what this, when this guy made that 911 call, I think he wanted to raise the rhetoric, is what I think he wanted to do. And I think people got to quit putting this on Islam. You know, basically, that's all I really wanted to say.
Great. Thank you, Carol, for the call. And Stephen, Carol making the point that this is homophobia we're dealing with here, and that's where she wants the focus to be. What do you say to that?
I agree. I don't think there's been any conclusive report that this was related to any, ISIS-related or from international perspective. And I don't think that focusing on the fact that this person was Muslim it really contributes to anything. What I'm really concerned with is that I think that assault rifles do not need to be on the street. People do need guns for protection or guns to hunt with, but an assault rifle is a military weapon that is made to kill large numbers of people in a very short amount of time, and it has really should not be available to the general public, in my view.
And Stephen, just very briefly as we wrap up, our last guest, Stephen Petro, was saying that when you do see these big advances in LGBT rights, like the legalization of same-sex marriage by the Supreme Court last year, that he says you do see this hateful response sometimes bringing back after there is big progress. Do you see that as part of what's happening here?
I agree with that. We've seen when there LGBT issues have been in the news that hate crimes spike. When there's been advances in political in politics or legal bills for the LGBT community, it seems that there is a backlash. And so I think that this is an example of that.
Stephen, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
That was Stephen Starkey, Executive Director of Outreach, South Central Wisconsin's LGBT Community Center. You can hear more about this issue tomorrow on The Joy Cardine Show. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll continue our coverage of the mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida this weekend with reaction from Mark Pocan, the U.S. representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District.
First, images of desirable and acceptable body sizes and shapes fill TV screens, magazines, and movies. For the vast majority of us, there's no way that we will ever come close to, let alone live up to those ideals.
And while intellectually we may know that it's okay, the impact on our mental, physical, and sexual health can still be huge, at least according to some new research that shows that girls' self-esteem peaks when they are 9 years old. And more than 90% of girls aged 15 to 17 years old want to change at least one aspect of their physical appearance, with body weight ranking the highest.
Those negative feelings about their bodies can lead girls to unhealthy behaviors that can have a lasting impact. Our next guest is looking at whether the equation can be turned around. If by developing positive body image and body appreciation, girls' emotional and physical health can be improved. Virginia Ramsayer Winter is an assistant professor and researcher in the School of Social Work at the University of Missouri. She studies body image in relation to women's physical, mental, and sexual health. Ginny, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Where do women, young and older, get ideas about what their bodies should look like?
We are really surrounded by messages and images of an ideal body type that, as you mentioned, is unattainable for the majority of women. So parents, peers, and the media.
And so how do those internalized images play out in the physical health of girls and women?
In a number of ways. For example, those who have worse body image are less likely to get screened for cancer, less likely to seek preventative care. They may avoid the doctor to avoid being weighed or engage in unhealthy weight control behaviors, just as a few examples.
And are there also mental health implications?
Absolutely. Poor body image is related to depression, anxiety, and eating disorders.
And what about sexual health? Do we see a difference in at what age, for instance, girls become sexually active if they have a lower self-esteem and body image?
Sure. The relationship between body image and the age of onset of sexual intercourse is actually pretty mixed, and we don't have a good answer for that one. But body image is related to various other sexual behaviors, such as condom use and hormonal contraceptive use, amount and frequency of sex, etc.
So it sounds like maybe the girls who have a lower body image of for themselves are maybe feeling less in power of their sexual expressions.
Yes, absolutely.
So you take a strengths-based approach to how expectations of appearance and body image can impact women. What exactly does that mean?
So positive body image is a distinct construct. It's not necessarily the inverse of negative body image. So just because a woman isn't dissatisfied with her body doesn't mean that she loves it and appreciates it and respects it. So we don't know for sure, even though negative body image is related to risky behaviors, we don't know for sure that positive body image is related to preventative behaviors or protective behaviors.
You use the term body appreciation in your work. Why do you use that term? What is it about appreciating our bodies that might give us a better overall image of ourselves?
Sure. I think that even if we are unhappy with our appearance in some way, we can still appreciate it. So, for example, if a woman is unhappy with the size of her stomach, she may still appreciate it because it was what allowed her to carry her child. Does that make sense?
It does. And do you think that it seems like in the last maybe decade or so, there's been more of an emphasis on helping women and girls feel good about being strong, that having muscles is a positive thing. Do you see that as one of the ways that maybe we can turn around some of those unattainable body images that we see?
Absolutely. And I think we just need to promote acceptance of all body sizes and types.
So if we're able to encourage that appreciation of what our body can do for us and how it can work for us, what impacts do you think we might be able to see if we're able to succeed in that?
That's a good question. And unfortunately, the majority of existing research in this area focuses on negative body image and risky behaviors. There's a growing body of literature that focuses more on positive body image, so it's still unclear. But I would hypothesize that an improvement in health outcomes would be a result, and perhaps overall well-being. I think women spend a lot of their time thinking about and doing something about their appearance, and it would be a very freeing experience if women could put that energy elsewhere, in their career, education, family.
And would those other aspects, you know, focusing on other accomplishments that are not necessarily tied so closely to our body, but our minds and our emotions and our ability to make life better for the people around us, might that also have some positive impact on physical and mental health?
Absolutely. Yes. That's a great point.
So have you or others been able to directly study the correlation between positive body image and good health? Or how would you study that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I've done some research on body appreciation and preventative sexual health behaviors and did find that women, it was a study of 18 to 25-year-old college women, and found that the women who had higher levels of body appreciation did engage in more preventive sexual health behaviors. So things like communicating with their partners about sexually transmitted infections before engaging in sex, using some sort of protection to prevent pregnancy if that wasn't what they wanted at the time, getting their vaccinations for human papillomavirus, those sorts of things.
And so we know that there are these unattainable images of what women look like and how they act in kind of the popular media. But maybe I just want to believe this, but it seems like, for instance, mothers or any adults around a young girl can really help shape how she sees herself and how she sees other girls and women.
Absolutely. And we need to take those roles really seriously because you're right. I think moms in particular, but also dads, can play a big role in girls' lives. when moms and dads are talking a lot and engaging in dieting behaviors, that sends a message to their children that their bodies are not okay. If they are trying to control their daughter's body size or suggesting that she go on diets, that can certainly send the wrong message to young girls.
It also seems just anecdotally that people are much more likely to compliment a little girl on being cute or, oh, you know, what beautiful hair you have, or, oh, give me a smile, or things like that, that really focus on the physical appearance. Are there some things that you can suggest that we should be saying to a young girl that will also boost her self-esteem but not based on how she looks?
Absolutely. We need to be telling girls how strong they are, how smart they are, how they make good decisions, what a good friend they are, rather than focusing on those appearance-based aspects.
And as we wrap up, Ginny, what about those of us who are well removed from our childhoods or are fully adults and have gotten those messages not just as we were young, but they've stayed with us as we've gotten older? Is there any hope for us to be able to turn around those ideas and those perceptions we have of ourselves and really start to appreciate our bodies?
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly it's not as easy because, as you said, we have been getting these messages for a long time. But there are several things that we can do ourselves. We can surround ourselves with peers and friends who don't engage in fat talk, for example. So when women say, does this make me look fat? Does this outfit look bad on me? Those sorts of things. And that may just require a conversation with a friend. You know, I'd really appreciate it if you didn't talk negatively about your body in front of me, because that's something I'm trying to work on. We can also do that on social media. There are a lot of great folks on social media that are really promoting body positivity. So just when you get on Facebook, seeing your feed filled with positive messages about different body sizes, I think is helpful. But we also really need to address this at the policy level. I think that's what's really lacking. We tend to try to change body image at the individual level. But we need to see fewer of these ideal images around us, and I think that's going to take policy changes.
Well, Ginny, thanks so much for spending time with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Ginny Ramsayer Winter. She is an assistant professor and researcher in the School of Social Work at the University of Missouri, where she studies body image in relation to women's physical, mental, and sexual health. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Over the weekend, a shooter in Orlando, Florida, killed 49 people and injured at least 53 at a gay nightclub. This is the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history, and it's left the LGBT community and many others in mourning.
Yesterday, President Obama gave a statement on the shooting, condemning how easy it is to get an assault rifle.
This massacre is therefore a further reminder of how easy it is for someone to get their hands on a weapon that lets them shoot people in a school or in a house of worship or a movie theater or in a nightclub.
The suspect used a military-inspired semi-automatic rifle, the same weapon used in several other mass shootings in the United States, including the shooting last December in San Bernardino, California.
Congressman Mark Pocan joins us now to share his reaction to the shooting. He represents Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. He's also co-chair of Congress's LGBT Equality Caucus. Congressman Pocan, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So what was your initial reaction when you first heard news of the shooting in Orlando?
You know, I first heard about it in the morning, and I heard there were 20 deaths, and just, you know, again, horrified by yet another mass shooting, not even knowing at the time what the circumstances were. And then to find out, you know, it went up to 49 people, to find out that it was targeted at an LGBT club during Pride Month, and to find out that it was someone who was self-radicalized. It just hits so many areas that we're not dealing with in Congress, and I think just a real frustration that I'm tired of moments of silence on the floor of Congress. It's time for moments of action.
And in the statement you released this morning about the shooting, you say, though, that you don't think Congress will do anything about the issues brought up by this shooting. Why not?
Well, you know, one, Congress has just been really, honestly, too chicken to address the epidemic of military-style assault weapons. They're afraid they're going to upset the NRA and gun manufacturers, so we just simply don't deal with it other than to have more moments of silence. Secondly, it's the very rhetoric on the floor of Congress and by our candidates for office when it comes to talking about Muslims, when it talks about people who are LGBT, that just that, you know, a couple weeks ago on the floor of Congress, we're putting in amendments to bills that were completely unrelated to roll back protections and employment for gays and lesbians, and then we're shocked when these kind of actions happen. We have to have a disconnect between the rhetoric that we use in order to score political points and the reality of what that has to real people's lives, and how someone like this, you know, is obviously crazy as this person was to commit such a horrific act, when he sees justification or he sees in his mind a member of Congress, you know, blaming, or a presidential candidate blaming all Muslims, this just somehow reinforces what they do. And we have to be much more careful, I think, as members of Congress and as elected officials.
You packed a lot into there, and I want to pull a few threads out of there. Going back to the military-style assault weapons, what justification do you hear from your colleagues in Congress for making sure that a vast number of people in this country can go out and buy these military-style weapons?
Well, you know, they always have an excuse how, you know, this is the Second Amendment. And let's face it, we didn't have military-style weapons when the Second Amendment was passed. There's a whole half-hour discussion we could have just on that point. But the bottom line is, when it's that easy for someone like this individual who was often on a watch list to be able to purchase that weapon, and then use it for mass destruction, that's a problem. And we need to either directly address these assault weapons or at minimum address people who are on watch lists shouldn't be able to buy a weapon. They can fly. They can't fly in this country. They're not allowed to fly in an airplane, but they can buy guns, and the Republicans are unwilling to do anything about that. I just think there's some really common sense measures that I think the vast majority of the public can really agree with, that would really make it so that we don't have to constantly have these tragedies.
So if this mass shooting doesn't bring back the ban on military-style assault rifles, and the attack on Sandy Hook and kindergartners and teachers didn't bring back the ban on military assault rifles, is there anything that will, in your opinion?
Well, the best thing we have going for us is the ballot box in November, and the single best way to influence a politician is to give them the hook and fire them and elect people who will do something if they won't. I think that may be the best way, because I think the public is way ahead of us on this. When I posted on Facebook my comments on this, I believe it might be the single greatest response I've had in about 3.5 years from people. The public certainly is fed up with this. They're fed up with the inaction in Congress, and they're fed up with how easy it is for someone to get an assault rifle and to do something like this. And if we can't respond, people are going to respond for us, and that's what they can do at the ballot box.
But wouldn't you say also that the NRA has such wide-reaching influence that it's not just a matter of one party or the other? There are many members of Congress who are taking money from the NRA.
Yeah, but what I'm looking at, you know, who sponsors the bills and who's blocking the action, there's unfortunately one political party right now that's doing that, and that's the leadership party. So that's our first problem we have, is how do you get to the floor of Congress the opportunity to vote on a ban on military-style assault weapons? How do you get to the floor of Congress the ability to stop someone who's on a watch list from buying a gun? And the only way that happens is for the speaker and the majority party to put it there. So that is kind of our first line of attack on this. But I think that, you know, people, again, are just completely fed up, and I think they have to speak out. And you can stand up to the NRA, and I think, you know, the vast majority of responsible gun owners will do that. I mean, we're not saying taking away your hunting rifle in Wisconsin. I mean, that's a very different situation. But no one goes out hunting with a military-style assault weapon that can cause this kind of tragedy this quickly.
We're talking with Congressman Mark Pocan. He represents Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. He's also the co-chair of Congress's LGBT Equality Caucus. And Congressman Pocan, as a gay man, what is your reaction to this shooting aside from your position as a member of Congress?
Well, you know, I think this is just one of those reminders, unfortunately, that even though we've had a lot of progress in things like marriage equality and the public support and understanding that they want to respect everyone regardless of who you love, that there are still people who want to fight against basic equality, and sometimes their language and their actions can be such that really elicit things like this. I mean, I remember, God, 20... 7 or so years ago when I was beaten by two people with a baseball bat simply for being gay. This still happens in America in 2016, and when someone in Congress does something that adds to the ability that someone might act on that, that's simply wrong. And you know, I think when I see something like this, it's just that reminder there's so much more work left to do. Even though this person, some people might say, you know, was an extremist or was crazy, I can count, I can show you scores of other times where someone has had hate speech or hate actions because I think all too often people accept discrimination still. So it was really, I think, painful for me to see just that many people in such, you know, sorrow over what happened. And you got to remember the victims and their families at a time like this.
As you said, violence against the LGBT community is certainly nothing new, but this shooting on the scale of the tragedy is certainly unusual and unique. How do you think this shooting will affect the LGBT community nationwide?
Well, you know, first, I know a lot of people are very scared right now. I've seen comments on social media and other, you know, just that they feel like we finally we're moving into a place of equality, and then you see things like this happen. But I just would remind everyone is, you know, look at the fight we're still having over the Confederate flag in the South. We have to find our alliances with others who also are struggling, who also are trying to fight for getting to be treated fairly and with respect. And we have to really band together on this. And I think that, you know, whether you're someone who is African-American, whether you're someone who's gay or lesbian, someone who is Jewish or Muslim, we should be able to, you know, all stand together that discrimination of any kind is wrong. And I think if we do that, I think it will give us the strength to realize that the vast majority of people are supportive. It's just really a small number, but a vocal number that aren't.
You mentioned early in the interview that this is an example of someone becoming self-radicalizing, but the father of the suspect said that this didn't have anything to do with religion. This was really something that his son did because he was so offended by seeing two men kissing a month earlier in Miami. Do you think that pointing to the religious and ethnic background of the shooter is actually weakening the element of homophobia that this attack represents?
Well, I think the fact that he, you know, declared allegiance to ISIS on the phone as he's doing it tells us his father maybe wants to think of his son in a certain way. But the reality is this is someone who acted and said it was something in allegiance to ISIS. And again, just coming back from the Middle East and, you know, talking to Palestinians and who've, you know, laid down our arms, are trying to find peace in a two-state solution with the vast majority of people who are Jewish and Palestinian. And yet when you still see the injustices, you know, when you have a population of 50% under 18, that's what breeds someone who could potentially be a terrorist. And, you know, I just think I heard it over and over and over. You know, if we had just in that one region, that one example, if you took that away, and if we actually had a peace process that worked, you would take away the largest argument that these extremists like ISIS have. So I do think that our actions have consequences, and certainly our words, like Donald Trump, when he says we're going to ban all Muslims, grouping an entire you know, set of people together very unfairly and very discriminatory, it doesn't help us to get what our goals are across the world.
Acknowledging that you are not part of the majority party in Congress right now, but what do you as a U.S. congressman plan to do in response to this tragedy to try to affect change?
Well, one, you know, I'm going to take advantage of a speech on the floor. We get 1 minute either later today or tomorrow, and I'm going to talk just about what we're talking about. Two, you know, the Progressive Caucus, which I serve as the first vice chair, is talking about what else we can do. But up member to member, we're already having this conversation today. How do we respond to yet another moment of silence that goes nowhere? How do you get us to having a moment of action? How do we force the majority party to act? And I think that's the discussions we're going to have this week.
Congressman Pocan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Judith.
That was Congressman Mark Pocan, who represents Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. He's also the co-chair of the Congressional LGBT Equality Caucus. He joined us to share his reaction to the mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, that happened early yesterday morning.
Stay with us. There's more to come. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Last night at the Tony Awards, the hit musical Hamilton won the day with 11 Tony Awards in total. And the show's writer and star, Lin-Manuel Miranda, accepted his award with a sonnet that he wrote for his wife, Vanessa. The sonnet went from Broadway to Orlando, where an act of domestic terrorism took 49 lives. It moved a lot of people last night.
The show is proof that history remembers. We live through times when hate and fear seem stronger. We rise and fall and light from dying embers, remembrances that hope and love last longer. And love is 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 love cannot be killed or swept aside. I sing Vanessa's symphony. Eliza tells her story. Now fill the world with music, love, and pride. Thank you so much for this.
That's Lin-Manuel Miranda accepting his Tony Award last night for the musical Hamilton. And we'll be talking more about the life of Alexander Hamilton with a historian from UW-Platteville tomorrow. We'll try to figure out what it is about Hamilton, his life and his story, that's making him the coolest founding father.
We go to the news with the song Alexander Hamilton.
Alexander.